The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 18th of May 2022 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Studio One here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's programme, Turkey's foreign minister visits his American counterpart. Exchange of views likely to be full and frank. Also ahead,
the accused continued to disseminate on a wide scale protected information, including the names of hundreds of protected witnesses, using organized press conferences and other media appearances.
Kosovo's War Crimes Tribunal delivers its first verdict. Later in the show, we'll ponder the possibility of an EU versus UK trade war. We'll look at Japan's tentative welcome back of tourists. And Fernando Augusto Pacheco will preview a happy occasion.
Hello, Andrew. Yes, indeed. Today's the wedding day for former Brazilian President Lula. Will it influence the campaign later in the year? We'll find out.
That's all coming up right here on The Briefing on Monocle 24. And welcome to today's edition of The Briefing with me, Andrew Muller. There is probably never a non-tricky time for a Turkish foreign minister to visit Washington, D.C., but Mevlut Çavuşoğlu would have reason for earnestly wishing he didn't have to be there this of all weeks, as his boss, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has vaguely threatened to obstruct the accession to NATO of new applicants Finland and Sweden. I'm joined with more on this by Hannah Lucinda Smith, Istanbul journalist and author of Erdogan Rising. Hannah, Mevlut Çavuşoğlu will be meeting with Secretary of State Antony Blinken. How much of an earful do we think Turkey's foreign minister is likely to get?
Yeah, well, as you say, Çavuşoğlu does not have an enviable job. The way that these things usually go in Turkey is that President Erdogan kind of makes very, very clear the things that he's unhappy about. He does that sort of for a domestic audience. He really kind of plays up the fact that Turkey is going to take a stand. And then it's left to the diplomats, the head diplomat being Çavuşoğlu, to try and smooth things over in the background and keep these relations going. Now, clearly, the relationship between Turkey and the US is not an easy one, and it hasn't been easy for a really long time. So the mechanism that that Çavuşoğlu is meeting Blinken under today was set up in October last year as a result of talks between Biden and Erdogan as a way to try and get this relationship back on track after a number of rows about different things, about the US's support to Kurdish factions in Syria, about the US, as Turkey claims, harboring the man they accuse of plotting the coup in 2016, Fethullah Gulen, about Turkey buying a Russian missile defense system. But now, of course, there's another issue that's added onto that list, which is the fact that Erdogan is now saying that he might try and block Sweden and Finland from joining NATO, again, because he says that they're not doing enough, or in fact, they're actively harboring terrorists connected to the PKK, Kurdish militant group operating in Turkey. So it's not going to be an easy trip for Çavuşoğlu, let's say.
I mean, it's always a question to which there is rarely a short answer, the one of what President Erdogan is upset about. But is he actually genuinely upset about what he's claiming to be upset about, or is he hoping to leverage this situation to his own advantage? Because surely nobody seriously believes right now that Turkey is going to veto Finland and Sweden's NATO membership.
Here's the thing. I mean, President Erdogan is a leader who has made really, really good use of a sense of victimhood, a sense that, you know, Turkey is not treated fairly in the world. It's not treated fairly by the EU. It's not let it in for decades on end. It's not treated fairly by the US, who supports, you know, Kurdish factions, the factions it considers as enemy in Syria. So this is something that he's found has played really, really well in the past with a domestic audience. And I think the key thing here is next year, 2023, we are coming up to really, really key elections, both presidential and parliamentary. President Erdogan is really on shaky ground. All the polls are showing that he's in his weakest position that he's been for nearly two decades. He came into power in 2003, and his opinion polls, both personal and for his party, have never been so low. So I think, you know, really, we have to look at it through that lens. You know, the idea that Turkey would, you know, go so far at a time like this in the world, and in its, you know, immediate neighbourhood, to block these two countries from joining NATO, like you say, I mean, it's just kind of unthinkable. You know, it's going to put relations on bad terms with so many key allies. But in the shorter term, you know, this kind of thing plays really well. And, you know, the thing that I think is quite hard to understand about Turkey, even though it's a really long-term NATO member, it joined NATO in 1952. You know, NATO is really, really vital for Turkish security. Just look at where it is in the world. There is still this, you know, really strong undercurrent, not necessarily amongst, you know, Turkish officials or the Turkish military, but amongst the Turkish population, a kind of anti-NATO and particularly anti-American sentiment. This feeling of, you know, why are we part of this alliance? Why are we not fully independent? Why are we dragged into these kind of, you know, conflicts that have nothing to do with us? And I think that's the sentiment that he's trying to play on here.
Is it possible, given everything you've just said, that the United States might tell Erdogan that he's possibly pushing his luck a bit far at this point? There are very serious things in play. As you say, Erdogan might not be president all that much longer. Is it possible that the message that his foreign minister will receive will be more or less along the lines of, look, seriously, we don't have time for this, get with the program?
I think it might be. I mean, Biden and his administration have shown since they came into power that they just do not have time for these kind of games by Erdogan. They're not indulging him nearly as much as, you know, Donald Trump did. And I think, yeah, you know, there is a sense, I think, in the US that, you know, maybe all it needs is just to buy time, just to stick it out until somebody else comes into power in Turkey. Now, whether that's going to pay off, who knows? You know, as I say, Erdogan is weakened. However, it's really, really foolish to ever write him off. He's very, very good, not necessarily at international relations. In fact, he's burnt quite a few bridges in recent years. But he's very, very good at doing domestic politics in Turkey. And I think, you know, anyone, you know, whether in the US or anywhere else, who's going to kind of say, well, he's definitely going to go in 2023, I think they stand to look quite foolish at the end of it.
Hannah Lucinda Smith in Istanbul, thank you for joining us. Here is Monocle's Emma Searle with the day's other headlines.
Thanks, Andrew. Russia says almost 1,000 Ukrainian fighters have surrendered from the bunkers and tunnels below Mariupol's Azovstal steelworks since Monday. Those leaving the steelworks are being taken to Russian-controlled territory. The apparent surrender of the final stronghold in Mariupol will cede full control of the city to Russia. Finland and Sweden have formally submitted their applications to join NATO. Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg personally accepted the Nordic countries' membership applications at the NATO headquarters in Brussels this morning. Sweden and Finland's decision to apply for membership is seen as one of the biggest geopolitical consequences to date of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And the Monocle Minute today reports on how Los Angeles will implement some of its harshest ever water restrictions to combat a severe drought. The city hopes that the measures will slash its water use by 35%. You can read more about that story by heading to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's headlines. Back to you, Andrew.
Thank you, Emma. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, the Northern Ireland Protocol was part of the Brexit agreement between the UK and the EU, enthusiastically sold by UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson as oven ready. In common with other aspects of Brexit, it may have been more like half-baked. The UK is proposing now to unilaterally rewrite the agreement for reasons of domestic politics, and the EU is suggesting that in such an event, it may unleash the dogs of trade war. Now, I'm joined with more on this fight by Vicky Price, economist and former joint head of the UK government's economic service. Vicky, first of all, if we try to see this from the UK government's point of view, are there actually sound reasons for wanting to rewrite the protocol at this point? Or is it more the case that picking fights with the EU is really all they've got?
It's political. I think they want to ensure they keep the DUP sort of on site, if you like. And of course, there are problems in terms of having a parliament in, running as Stormont. So that's a big issue. So they need to sort that out somehow. Now, whether this is the best way of sorting it out is a big question mark. And if the EU indeed retaliates, then that will start a trade war, which the UK can ill afford right now.
The UK is floating this idea of a red channel and a green channel. So it's a bit of a halfway house between, I guess, the current protocol and what the UK would actually prefer in an ideal world. If implemented, would it make much in the way of practical difference to anything?
Well, it could. I mean, what we've seen is that exports from Great Britain to Northern Ireland have been coming down. So there is definitely an issue in terms of being able to sort of access the market as one did before. And there have been complaints from businesses, but not all businesses, but certainly there have been complaints by some sectors that they're having difficulty and extra costs in accessing goods from Great Britain. And that's an issue. On the other hand, of course, Northern Ireland has increased its trade with Ireland itself quite significantly, you know, since Brexit actually started being implemented. So that's a positive thing for them, possibly. But it would make a difference in terms of speeding things up when things going just to Northern Ireland. So the whole idea is to separate the ones that just stay in Northern Ireland and those that might go for on selling, if you like, or go into the EU properly, if you like, because they're then going into Ireland itself. So that's one element, which of course is against what the protocol agreement is at present. So we would need some new legislation. Let's see how they react. But there is an extra one, which is quite worrying, which is that they're also suggesting that there should be a dual regulatory regime. So in other words, businesses will be allowed to choose between whether they meet sort of UK or EU standards. And that, of course, is completely against what the protocol says. And it's also, of course, implies that any rules on state aid or on VAT and also the role of the European Court of Justice would no longer apply in Northern Ireland, which, again, is against the protocol. So it's not just the speeding up of traffic, of goods traffic, if you like, but it's also, you know, much more important in terms of what it does about the ECJ, which has been an issue all along, of course, in the Brexit negotiations.
The EU, it is fair to say, are not caring to disguise their irritation with these developments. We've seen Germany's EU spokesperson, Sebastian Fischer, for one, tweeting, "Let's just all threaten each other with breaking international law makes for really good partnerships." I suspect he may have been being sarcastic. But what can the EU actually materially retaliate with?
Well, it's not the best of times, of course, for anyone to engage into a trade war, given that we have so many other issues to deal with, such as the real war in Ukraine. But of course, they could just suspend the whole thing or just say that the trade and cooperation agreement no longer holds. So they could start imposing tariffs on goods and make life more difficult. They could also take away some of the other in terms of movement of people and so on, where there has been some sort of give and take, if you like, they could suspend that as well. So that could be, you know, pretty bad for services and so the wider economy. What they can do, therefore, is just, say it's no longer valid or apply some sanctions themselves. So it can be complete withdrawal from the agreement, which you're allowed to do. Or it could be a partial sort of increase of tariffs in some areas. So they could also do, as people have been saying already, they could just, which they're allowed to do, attack particular areas, such as fishing, for example, and make it much more difficult for the Brits to fish in waters which we have agreed we can fish in for the time being, at any rate. So there are all sorts of issues there, but basically would mean higher costs for the UK. And given that we already had some serious supply chain problems since Brexit, which have been worse here than they have been elsewhere, even though lots of countries have been suffering supply chain issues. That, of course, will mean that the cost to our own manufacturers will increase and competitiveness will suffer and so on and so forth. But it's not the best time to be doing anything that might actually increase inflation in this country when we're looking at figures of 9% as we had this morning for the month of April.
Vicky Price, thank you as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing. This is The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, 23 years since the end of the war to which it is applying justice, the Kosovo Specialist Chambers in The Hague has returned its first verdict. Two Kosovo Liberation Army veterans have been sentenced to 4.5 years each after being convicted of intimidating potential witnesses to further such trials. I'm joined with more on this by Monocle's Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay. Guy, first of all, what is the verdict and who has been verdicted?
Well, the people verdicted, Andrew, love that. Nassim Haradinaj and Hisni Gusati, and they weren't just any old veterans, they were the leaders of the Kosovo Liberation Army Veterans Association. And what they've been convicted of is, as you've said, leaking information about what was going on at the court. And this is crucial because it isn't just a case of these trials are going ahead, these people are being charged, but they were naming witnesses. They were identifying who might have been called to testify against senior former leaders of the Kosovo Liberation Army. They were calling them all sorts of names, including traitors, and they were making it very clear where these people could be found. They, as the judge said, clearly held in contempt not just the court, but anybody who wanted to cooperate with this. And they were absolutely brazen in this contempt, staging a series of press conferences in which they divulged this confidential information, leaks from the court, and actually encouraged people to come forward with more so they could leak that as well.
I mean, it was all weird at any number of levels, but it's important to clear up that one of the weirdnesses of it is that this is not some international court dispensing remote justice. This is actually a Kosovar court operating under Kosovar law, isn't it?
And it's set up by a Kosovo Act of Parliament. And this is the thing, and it illustrates why the court was set up in the way that it's been set up. They were always concerned about these issues of judicial interference and witness intimidation. So they set up the Kosovo Specialist Chambers in The Hague with international officials. So none of the judicial officials are from Kosovo at all. It's largely funded by the United States and the European Union. But it is a court of Kosovo, even though it's in The Hague. And it had, at the time it was set up 5 years ago, it had the support of the President of Kosovo and the National Assembly of Kosovo. That doesn't mean it hasn't been the subject of sniping by politicians ever since. It certainly has. But the extraordinary thing with Gusati and Haradinaj, the two men who've been convicted today, is they thought that they could get away with these public press conferences divulging all this confidential information and that nothing would happen. And rather gloriously, the Kosovo Specialist Chambers, who have police on the ground in Kosovo, said, well, no, that's not how it goes down, promptly swooped, picked them up, took them to The Hague, and the 4.5 year sentence is the result.
But that brazenness to which you allude does suggest a certain belief on their part that they had an amount of public support. How would you quantify that now? Because these are not the last trials that the Kosovo Specialist Chambers will consider. Indeed, there's some very high-profile ones coming up, including that of senior KLA commander and indeed former Kosovo president, Hashim Thaçi. How do people in Kosovo see this now? Because at one level, the KLA leadership are still regarded as the leaders of a heroic liberation struggle, and not entirely without reason.
You've got it in a nutshell there, Andrew. People in Kosovo, 90% of whom are ethnic Albanian. Now, this ethnic Albanian majority does indeed view the Kosovo Liberation Army as an instrument of righteous struggle, that in the late 1990s, they were the defenders of the Kosovo-Albanian people who were suffering under the government of Yugoslavia, which was run at that time by Slobodan Milosevic, who was utterly notorious and who was highly prejudiced against Kosovo Albanians to the point where their lives and livelihoods were in peril. It was only because of the fight of the Kosovo Liberation Army and the later intervention by NATO, many Kosovo Albanians believe, that they are living in an independent country today. Of course, that's a country which unilaterally declared its independence, and that's a complicated matter as well. But the view is, and I think it's safe to say, this is widely held in Kosovo today, is that the senior leaders of the Kosovo Liberation Armies were heroes of a liberation struggle, which was a righteous struggle, and they should not be standing trial for war crimes or crimes against humanity. And how they feel about them as politicians and governors of Kosovo since its unilateral declaration of independence is another matter. But when it comes to the liberation struggle, they're definitely coming down on the side of these men being heroes.
Guy Delaunay, thank you very much as always for joining us. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. You're back with The Briefing on Monocle 24. Now, since the COVID-19 pandemic began, Japan has taken fewer chances than most countries where the outside world is concerned. It raised the drawbridges early and is only just now beginning to winch them back down again. Having begun to admit business people and students, Japan has now announced that what it describes as test tourism will begin this month. For more on what this will actually mean, I spoke a short while ago to Monocle's Tokyo Bureau Chief Fiona Wilson. I began by asking what the new rules are.
I don't think people should get too excited just yet. It's very limited. It's tour groups from the US, Australia, Thailand, Singapore. They have to be triple vaccinated, small groups, fixed itineraries. And it's really being announced as a test, a trial run. It's a very cautious opening, but it is something anyway.
This is, as you say, an incredibly tentative way to go about it. Does that suggest that there is a reverse gear back into isolation here if this doesn't work well?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, really, it's probably in step with the way people, you know, it's the way the whole pandemic has gone for Japan. People have been quite happy to be masked, to be cautious. They were quite happy the borders were closed. And I think opening has to be a slow process to keep the population on board. And at the moment, it's been a gradual prising open. They opened up 1st of March. They opened up to some business people, foreign students who've been waiting for visas for 2 years. I mean, we haven't had tourists in Japan for 2 years. So it's been a long process. And I think people were waiting to see Golden Week, this big Japanese holiday. Did infection numbers go up after that? They did slightly. That's just happened, Golden Week. And it's just a slight rise, but nothing major. So I think they feel confident now in going ahead with this trial, which should have happened in December, I have to say. But Omicron took over in December and the whole thing was shut down. So cautious, but positive first steps, I think.
Is it possible to get a sense of how public opinion feels about this, whether people are excited about welcoming the world back or perhaps a bit apprehensive, or perhaps some people have rather enjoyed the peace and quiet?
I think all of the above, actually. I think it's a bit of, you know, and particularly in some places like Kyoto, I think it's been a shock to the economy in Kyoto, but quite nice for residents. Very, very busy there with tourists before then. So, yeah, I think it's a bit of everything. And when you see polls, NHK did a poll, and it was, you know, a third of people said they were quite happy to keep the borders closed. I mean, you know, continue to keep them closed. So it's not exactly there will be a warm welcome once people see that it goes okay. But I think, you know, Prime Minister Kishida, you know, he knows the population and he knows they want to do it gradually. And it's also about raising the daily limit has only been 10,000. They're going to raise that to 20,000 a day. And that's for everyone, business people, you know, that number is not that high. So I think for the airlines, it's just early stages at this point.
I mean, despite the limitations on what tourists can do and how they can do it, would you recommend visiting Japan? Now, I ask because, as readers of Monocle's daily email bulletins will be aware, and frankly, who isn't a reader of one of Monocle's daily email bulletins? Tyler Brulé did recently visit Japan after a long absence, and he said in his report that it was rather akin to visiting Japan, perhaps in the 1990s, i.e. before it had been completely overrun.
Yeah, I think he was experiencing it in the way that a lot of us were experiencing it. It did feel like an older Japan. I mean, if you think in 2019, there were 32 million visitors, you know, that is quite a gap when they disappeared. I mean, I think, you know, a year later, it was 245,000. So massive drop in numbers. And that increase in tourism had happened so fast in Japan. I think that's why people talk about tourism so much in Japan. If it was really very negligible, the numbers 20 years ago. So it's really, it's increased massively. And I think that's where the rethink has had to come. It's like, do we want that many people in those few places? It's time to start spreading out tourism, making sure people get to see all the amazing things. So, yeah, I would say it's fantastic to come here. It's great to come here right now because it's still quiet. But even when it's, you know, back at full pelt, there are plenty of places you can go to find some peace and quiet in Japan.
Well, just finally on that subject, if we have between us managed to tempt anybody into visiting Japan, even under this new dispensation, as someone who's been there a long time and knows it well, what's something you'd recommend people see that might not necessarily occur to most prospective tourists?
Well, funnily enough, I would say, you know, there are many obscure places to go, but right now the place to go, I would say, is Kyoto, which is absolutely spectacular any time. But right now it's so quiet. You can go and see these incredible, these famous temples and gardens, and you can pretty much have them to yourself. And that's a very, very unusual experience these days. And, you know, in a year it will be quite different.
That was Fiona Wilson in Monocle 24's Tokyo Bureau speaking to me earlier. You are listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, on today's show, Fernando Augusto Pacheco joins me with a stack of newspapers and news of an imminently happy couple. Fernando, it's Lula's wedding day.
Absolutely. So it's quite a big story in Brazil, Andrew. And looking at O Globo, basically all the papers are covering the story, but I think O Globo gave some information because apparently it was supposed to be secretive. But I have a lot of details here to tell you, so maybe it's not that secretive.
I mean, you're not going to do something like this in the middle of an election campaign and keep it entirely under your hat, are you? Even if you want to, you're not going to get away with it.
Exactly. And actually, looking on the political side of things, it's interesting because Lula, this is his third marriage, but he's been a widow for his first and second. So it's a contrast to Bolsonaro, because Bolsonaro talked a lot about family values, but he had quite a lot of weddings and divorces and quite a lot of kind of family scandals.
I mean, but that's Bolsonaro's commitment to family values. He's had lots of them.
Exactly. So his wife is Rosângela da Silva. She's 55. Lula is 76. But I have to say, he looks quite a very fit 76-year-old. She's been an activist for the Workers' Party since 1983. And she met Lula kind of officially when he was in jail. So that was quite a...
Is that something you boast about? Is that something you sell as a romantic meet-cute? Where did you meet your husband? In the clink.
In the clink, exactly. But now, you know, and they are keeping to about 200 guests.
Okay.
And there's been kind of a minor controversy, as it happens in those weddings, about the type of drinking they will be, what they will be drinking. But I like that he chose...
Is drinking at weddings in Brazil controversial?
Well, the price of it, apparently.
Oh, I see. It's literally a champagne socialist.
Exactly. Well, but the good thing, the type of champagne he chose a Brazilian sparkling. Because Brazil, we don't have such a good wine industry yet. We're increasing, but our sparkling is quite good. And it cost 130 reais, which is about £20. I mean,
that's not outrageous.
That's not outrageous, but no. Anything becomes a scandal these days, right? But they also have some options for white wine, a little bit cheaper, you know, just 60 reais. You know, so, you know, if you're feeling a little bit more frugal there. And the guest list, former President Dilma Rousseff will be there. Mm-hmm. His vice president, Geraldo Alckmin, will be there as well. And let's remember, Geraldo Alckmin is a conservative. So I think Lula chose him as well to kind of say, you know, I'm a centrist. I want everyone anyone voting for me. I don't know yet how Rosângela Silva's dresses is. That's been kept in secret. But we'll look at the pictures tomorrow.
Hopefully we can discuss this at considerable length on tomorrow's briefing.
Of course,
Fernando.
Of course.
We will have to move reluctantly along to Cannes.
Yes, indeed. I have The Guardian here in front of me. Again, all the papers are covering the Cannes Film Festival. Yesterday was the first day. And there's an interesting story here, Andrew. A zombie film kicked off the festival. It's called Coupé, and it's kind of a comedy zombie film. So it's not such a horror. Peter Bradshaw here on The Guardian gave 3 stars. He said, zombies on loose in silly meta farce. But I think the Cannes Film Festival, they're in love with zombies. Because in 2019, I genuinely think so. It also kicked off.
How has that not been a film in itself called In Love with Zombies?
Exactly. So there's a lot of zombie love there in Cannes.
There's another title. we could do a franchise of these, Fernando.
But looking also, let's talk a little bit about politics here as well. President Zelensky from Ukraine, he was on a video link. He was a guest of honor. I mean, he's been doing that in quite a lot of big
events.
He has. And Cannes is no exception to that as well.
Fernando Augusto Pacheco, thank you for joining us. That is all for this edition of The Briefing. It was produced by Charlie Filmer-Court. Our researcher was Lillian Fawcett and our studio manager was Chris Ablakwa. The Briefing returns tomorrow at the same time, midday UK. I'll be your host for that as well as today's Monocle Daily at 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.